We're here today on Crew Call with filmmaker Bill Pohlad. He's the director of the film Dreamin' Wild, starring Casey Affleck and Zooey Deschanel, in theaters now. Bill, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Take us back to what got you into the filmmaking bug. Take us back to the movie Explorers.
Old Explorers? Well, that's a long time ago. But I've always wanted to be, you know, in the movie business, kind of grew up watching movies and wanted to, you know, like it changed me in so many different ways and taught me about life that I wanted to do that for other people, like have those kind of emotional epiphanies and things like that. Really love that dynamic and process and wanted to do that too. So I started off as a writer, writing kind of scripts in my spare time without really knowing what I was doing. But eventually I met a couple of guys in Minneapolis who wanted to do the same thing, try to do movies out of Minneapolis, which seems kind of crazy. But we did that, and we made a film called Old Explorers. So that's what got it started, to be honest.
And then after that, you began producing.
Yep.
Tell us about that, because, you know, a lot of early part of the millennium's great art house cinema, you know, you've been behind these movies like Brokeback Mountain and Into the Wild. How did that, tell us about going down, and of course, the Best Picture winner, 12 Years a Slave. But tell us about going down that route of producing before turning back to filmmaking again.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I made Old Explorers, that first movie a long time ago, you know, I raised money from family and friends and we didn't get the money back, you know, so I felt very guilty about that and bad about that. And I really didn't want to do that again. So I spent 10 years doing commercial and documentary films. But then eventually I wanted to get back into features. And so I engaged with Hollywood again and put my director's aspirations on the side in the background and, you know, just started producing. And again, in this situation, I think, I don't know if it's a typical situation, but, you know, if you go out to Hollywood and get engaged with the movie business, it all depends on who you meet. And if you meet good people, it's great. And if you meet bad, it's not so great. I was lucky enough to meet really good people and, you know, got hooked up in a series of projects that were great, you know, focus features and things like that. People like that. I just was lucky in who I met. So,
well, you met great filmmakers, Ang Lee, yeah. Terrence Malick, Steve McQueen. Can you tell me some of the takeaways from working with this great bunch? I mean, I got to imagine Malick alone is, you know, given the unique way that he works, he finds the film in the editing room and he has this wonderful, having spoken to people that have worked with him, he has this wonderful knack of, you know, we're not going to do the shot list today. Let's go run and shoot that butterfly.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the takeaways, like some of the key lessons that you took with you from working with these guys?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing for me anyway, was that I, you know, only wanted to do movies that I believed in, that I truly believed were going to be not successful, but artistically, you know, meaningful to me and hopefully artistically and financially meaningful for other people. But that was kind of the main premise for me. So I turned down a lot of things and said no to various projects because I really didn't want to spend my time or risk my time and money, you know, doing those kind of movies. So that led me to, you know, the better projects, I guess, you know, to have that discipline, that would be important. So, you know, when you jump over to Terry, Terrence Malick, I should say. But I mean, we've become close friends over the years. And you know, when people ask me at the beginning, what kind of movies do you want to make and who do you want to make them with? To be honest, I didn't have a list. I was not aspirational in the way, I'm a fan of this guy or that guy. So it really wasn't like that. I hate to say stumbled across, but I did meet Terrence Malick in the early days when he was trying to do a film called Shay, which ultimately was made with Steven Soderbergh. But that's when we met, and we became good friends through the process. And over the years, he would tell me or describe different stories to me in different projects. And we ultimately did Tree of Life together. So the things I've learned from Terrence Malick, they've been amazing. And obviously I don't, try to act like Terry either, because, you just want to be yourself. You need to be true to yourself. So that's kind of more important to me. And the relationship is underlying than it is to gravitate or jump on the project because somebody XYZ is doing it or something. So
roughly 14 years later, Love and Mercy, the script for Love and Mercy comes to you. What made you want to jump on that Brian Wilson project to direct? Like, why was that film? Why did that mark your return to directing?
Yeah, I guess I felt like at that point I had proved myself enough in producing it to be able to come out, so to speak, come out and let the world know that I wanted to direct again. And obviously I was looking around for different things, working on different things. Some people came into the office to talk about the Brian Wilson project, Love and Mercy. They wanted to know if we would help them out on it. I said, no. But if this doesn't work out for you guys, bring it back to me because the idea is really intriguing to me. So that's what happened. They ultimately came back, be able to get the movie made. So they came back and we took it over and started looking for a writer. Ultimately landed on Oren Moberman, who was the ultimate writer on the thing. And to be honest, through the process of meeting him and working with him, he was the one who convinced me that I should direct it because, he knew by that time what my sensibility was and what my vision was. And he really urged me to do it. So, yeah.
Had Brian Wilson been wanting to make this movie for some time?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things when it's based on a real person, the people aren't always convinced that it sometimes sounds like a great idea of a movie being made about your life. But, they're also a little bit mixed on whether they actually want it to be made because, it takes a lot of trust to give your, story over to a filmmaker, whoever it may be. And I don't know that he had come to that point of really buying off on it and trusting anybody. And then ultimately we got to that point with, he and I, so.
Did you have to persuade him? Hey, I'm the guy.
I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that we worked on the, script more and then presented to him. And Melinda, obviously, Melinda, his wife, is a big part of the decision making. So I think it was really just the script and the combination of that and me, getting to know me a little bit better, and that he would have that trust, or they would have that trust.
So along comes this New York Times article by Stephen Carruts about the Emerson brothers. Was that your first window into these guys and their rebound and their kind of all of a sudden, here they are, 1970s young songwriters at that time. And then all of a sudden in 2008, their album gets discovered by a record collector who begins passionately tub thumping for them. And they get on a record executive's radar. Tell me about that. Was that your first window, that article, or had you known about these?
Yeah, it was really that article. I mean, honestly, a friend of mine, Jim Burke, who's a producer on the movie, brought the project to me, pitched it to me as a director. And when he told me the story, I said, no. I said, basically, because it sounded a lot like Searching for Sugar Man, the documentary. And, you know, I thought they had done a great job with that film, and I really didn't want to do something over again, or, you know, the same idea. But he insisted, Jim insisted that I read the article, and actually Stephen Kuritz's extended article about the Emerson Brothers. And so I did that, and then I listened to the music, and obviously drew me in a lot. But really, it wasn't until going to Spokane and meeting the real Emersons, Joe and Donnie, that I was really captivated, you know, by it. I mean, it was really about the people, certainly Joe and Donnie, but also the family, the extended family, certainly the father and mother and, you know, so that was what really brought me into it.
Now, at the time that the father built the studio for them, he was going into arrears on the farm. Did their late success wind up helping him in the end?
It did help
them.
He
took a gamble on them.
It did help them. They got some money back, but not a great deal. It wasn't a windfall for them, for sure. So by the time I got involved and was meeting with them and the prospect of a movie, you kind of see maybe that this will be a second bump for them, which would be great. Because, I mean, by that time, I really was connected with the family and really knew them and wanted to see the best for them.
What struck you? Was it apparent that, look, obviously the jumping off point is this kind of late success that they had, and Ariel Pink covering their song Baby and turning that into a hit. But was it apparent to you when you met them, this kind of, you know, the movie deals with kind of the late success that Donnie has and the friction of that.
Yeah.
Was that there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that was somewhat there in Stephen's article or, you know, story. But then that first time that I met Donnie, and actually he picked us up at the airport and drove us out to the farm. And on the way back in the middle of the night, I was sitting next to him, and he's just talking as he's driving, and he bursts into tears. Like, he had this great emotional, you know, emotion pent up in him. And that's really what did it for me. It was like, wow, this guy is so vulnerable, and so raw and so authentic that's really what did it for me. So,
well, I was going to say, you know, Casey Affleck, you know, there's this shot that you have of him very early on in the film, where Chris Messina as comes in and is telling and is gushing over the album and the complexity. And this is very early on in the film. You hang this shot on Casey and it shows the complexity of his emotions. He runs through a series of, in his face, humility, unwant, scrutiny. It's just great.
Thank you.
Which leads me to why Casey? I mean, yes, Casey for the role, but how did you decide that he was right?
Well, I just, you know, I had gotten to know Donnie quite a bit by that point. And he is that kind of guy. Somebody can shift. He's like a regular guy, but then can suddenly shift into this, like he's in another world or something like that. slightly disconnected, slightly in another place in time. And I just thought that Casey has that ability to do that kind of shift from one kind of being to another. So that was really what did it for me, the ability. Well, he's a great actor. Obviously, you've seen him in a lot of fantastic roles. But it was that quality that really got me interested in Casey. And ultimately, he agreed to do it. To be honest, also, he didn't agree to do it until he actually went and met with Donnie, which is, you know, kind of cool. He went to Donnie's house unannounced and just showed up as Casey Affleck, you know, and he pitched a tent in Donnie's backyard and was there for 48 hours. But it was, you know, very impressive for Casey as well as for Donnie. So it was a cool episode.
Now, did you shoot this during COVID or shoot the movie before?
On the tail end of COVID. We obviously went through all the protocols, but in the Pacific Northwest at that point, there was not, you know, there was not a resurgence or anything like that. So we were in, we went through all the protocols, but it was all okay. We never had an incident at all. We weren't shut down for any reason. So we were lucky.
You've produced some excellent, you know, award-winning, you know, specialty cinema. What is your feeling about the sector right now, the theatrical sector? Because, you know, we've bounced back tremendously with tentpoles, and it looks like there is some hope for art house. But I was just curious because you're in a unique position as a producer. You have to be agnostic. You have to make the best deal. You know, yes, everybody wants to go theatrical, but sometimes you have to go streaming. It's just the nature of the business. Yeah. I'm wondering if you could talk about that, but also, you know, your feelings about the theatrical sector for these smaller films.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm still hopeful or we wouldn't be doing it. I mean, the sector is still viable. People go back to the theaters and be as adventurous as they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Right now, I suppose people aren't as, you know, apt to come out and take a chance on the movie. You know, to be honest, that's the main problem we have is getting people to see the movie. And you know, it doesn't help, obviously, that there's the SAG strike. And so Casey and Zoe and different people can't really promote it. So that's not helping. Any way that we can get the word out will be good, which is the same thing that everybody's trying for, even if you're Barbie. But you know, they obviously they're okay in getting the word out, but for a film like Dreamin' Wild, you just need to get people in the seats, or at least people in the seats who will talk about it and spread the word, you know, because you just can't do it again, particularly with the actors being not in the spotlight at the moment. Really hard to get people's attention.
When both of these strikesies, whenever that may be, do you have any projects in the hopper that are ready to go?
Yeah.
To go shooting.
We do. I mean, we have a script that we're very happy, that I'm happy with, and that we look forward to going forward on. But, you know, it still needs, we had a good enough script before the strike and we gave notes on it. So then you ultimately have to wait until the strike's over to execute on those notes and but hopefully we can put some of the pieces together on the film before that in anticipation of the strike being over. So,
Bill, you have a film in the fall film festivals this year called Fry Bread, Face and Me. If you could tell us more about that and its impact on the Native American community.
Yeah, I mean, I love the script and obviously a really low budget film, a very indie kind of filmmaker, and he did a great job and I love the film. What else can I say about it? I guess it's unlikely that we would have gotten involved in it, but it is so captivating in the script that I, you know, we all kind of jumped on board with it and are proud of it, very proud of it. So
the other question I wanted to ask you is, you know, we're coming on the 100 days of the WGA strike. And I was curious, as both a writer and producer, how you're reflecting on that. Are there certain issues that for feature film writers should be addressed that haven't been addressed? I'm just curious. We're reflecting on the 100 days here.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's tough, as all strikes are. Obviously, if you're in that kind of dispute, there's arguments on both sides. But I really do think that the writers have an argument, and we should be kind of getting some more traction in some of those areas. And, you know, hopefully it will work out. But it's obviously right now it's not, you know, most promising. And ultimately, everybody just wants to make movies. But clearly it's important that we all kind of stick with it and, you know, get some agreement that works for both of us, for all sides. So.
Bill Pollack, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Crew Call podcast on Deadline. Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode.